I'd like to ask you first of all, if I may, how did you become part of Greenham?
Right. I wasn't part of Greenham in the early years. Basically, I was an area manager working in London for Oxfam. I was very much aware of Greenham. But because of the political situation at the time, we were not, as management staff, really permitted to get too heavily involved with political acts. You know yourself as a charity. You're not allowed to. I couldn't. I mean, I had belonged to CM the years previously and things like that. You have to drop all those affiliations, especially with Margaret Thatcher, because it was just not a good thing at all, and not basically allowed as a charity. So I didn't get involved in the early days, but I actually subsequently left. I had lots of friends that had been, so I was very much aware and supportive. I then actually left Oxfam during that period. And when I did, I was left to go travelling. And I was had rented a little place in Devon. So I thought, oh, great. So going backwards and forwards between London and Devon, I can actually get to Greenham. So I did. So every time, I was doing the journeys backwards and forwards, I would stop with my old camper van. I had a Volkswagen camper van at the time. So I used to park up and stay a few days. And the thing was, at the end, there really was only Yellowgate that were there on a permanent basis. The other gates would come and go for the odd weekends and things like that. But they Yellowgate was the only permanent group of women that were left there, and quite low on numbers at some point. One of the women that had been there 9 years, which is I just found incredible. I learned so much from them. She only ever took a couple of weeks out over Christmas and New Year every year to go and see her family, which I just, other than the odd stint in prison, but either refusing or couldn't pay fines and things like that. So there was only a small bunch of women, so it was good in a way, because around the fire you got quite a lot of conversation, and I got a lot more information about what had gone on rather than just what was happening then. They were still trying, to get into the base and cause some havoc every now and again, but it was low key. It was about, we're still here. We haven't gone, and they were determined to let the camp, the base know that they were still there, even though there was only a few of them really compared. So it was a very low key event in that sense, but just they needed more numbers really. But of course the main era of Greenham had really sort of died right down really, and there wasn't a lot of publicity anymore, but there was just these hardline group of women who were just determined to stay there, and some women like me would visit, stay a few days and then move on and then come back or turn up at the weekend. So yeah, that basically, it was very quiet and very sort of low key compared to the high heydays of Greenham, shall we say.
And so, what year would it be then when you first arrived in your but is it was it was your van called Doris or something? Oh, Gladys.
Well, no, it's Gladys. What it is, if you refer back to the photographs, right, the van that they had with all the writing and stuff on the side, that van was called Gladys. And one day I turned up with a load of, I just used to turn up with some food and a few beers for the girls and things. And I turned up there, and they were in a real pickle because Gladys had died on them yet again. It was a very old vehicle, as you can see from the photograph. And they didn't know what to do because the garage, the guys, the garage in the local like the chaps there had been great in trying to keep it going for them for years. They were given it in the first place, but to try to keep it legal, so because it still had to be taxed and insured, because although it was on the common, they every time the bailiffs turned up, you had to put everything in it and drive it off the land, otherwise they would confiscate. So it was imperative that they had a vehicle that could do this. Anyway, it died in the garage. It said, look, it's just, it's habit. We can't repair it anymore. It's just ridiculously expensive now to try to do it and blah, blah. And they were really in a pickle because no money, what do you do? So I went, took myself off with one of the others into Newbury to see if we can. We went to the garage and I had a word with the guys. We had a word with the guys there and I said, have you got any vehicle that's cheap and cheerful that we can, you know, that is legal? And all they had was a car. I said, well, I've got no commercial vehicles, but we have got a car. And I said, well, that's no good because they need somewhere to store food and their belongings, really, basically. And so I said, the only other thing we can do is maybe hitch a little caravan to it, which I thought might be a good idea as well, because they're living in tents all weather. You know, so if it was a really horrible, you could just about cram a number of women at least into this little caravan, which would also store the stuff. And then I thought, well, that, the other added benefit of that is you could have, if they had a gas cylinder, they could perhaps have a little bit of, you know, boil a kettle in there rather than the fire, because if it's pouring with rain, they've had it. So that was the plan. That was the idea. So I went and bought a local paper, found somebody that was selling a caravan locally. I had a tow bar on the back, Gladys, but to get it back, but the car didn't. So but the guy said that they would put a tow bar on the car, meanwhile, off of an old car that they had. So long story short, we ended up, we had a car and a little tiny caravan, and we towed it and we got it back there. So Gladys died, basically, and so they decided to call my vehicle Sister of Gladys. That was her full title, because she kind of replaced it and saved the day, as it were. And so that's what they ended up with, as I say, the car and the little caravan. And the little caravan did work out to be quite a good plan, really, because it helped them, you know, to dry stuff out and things like that in the bad weather.
Sounds like a very creative solution.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, it didn't cost me a fortune, but I had enough to do that. It needs must on these occasions, don't they? So kept them going. Hopefully, kept them a bit more healthy in the winter, because I know a couple of the girls had ended up in hospital with pneumonia a few times and things like that in the winter months. Wasn't funny.
When you were there, Dawn, what was life like at the camp when you first arrived, and was it what you had expected it to be like?
Expected, I suppose, because I'd known a number of women who had been there and been there backwards and forwards all over the years, and spent a lot of time there. I wasn't shocked or surprised or anything. What for me, and I know it applied to the women that were there, was difficult, was the fact that they were only low in numbers and thereby felt very vulnerable at times. I mean, one night I was there and I was asleep, and there was a whole bunch of guys that had obviously gone past in some vehicle shouting abuse and, you know, what you need is a good effing and all this, you know, really sort of abusive, nasty stuff. And I thought to myself, you know, on some occasions there were only a handful of women there, sometimes at its lowest, which made them extremely vulnerable. Your safety is in numbers, obviously. So from that point of view, I was very much aware of that. Other than that, you know, life went on. They had the fire, they had their tents, they as I say, they had been there for so many years, a lot of them. Even if they weren't there permanently, they had been at that gate on and off for many, many years. That was the thing that really struck me, was the determination and the commitment from some of the women. It wasn't just a weekend jolly. This was serious commitment, and I have great admiration for them. And if, you know, the bit I did helped, then great, you know. But I know every time I did turn up, they said, oh, great, you know, we're low on numbers, Dawn, you know, we'd have to see you, that kind of thing. So I went as often as I could, really. I couldn't stay all the time, but I went as often as I could. And I was lucky because I had my camper van. I could stay in that as long as.
Yes. And it sounded as though you had a very good relationship with the garage. And I just wondered, what was the relationship like with the local residents or the military or the police?
Well, the police and the military, we know historically, were pretty appalling, really. I mean, they just had no tolerance for the women being there at all. And that was still going on. The women were convinced that they were zapped, you know, that this zapping was going on, which really caused them some distress and things. I think because I was there right at the end, they weren't, the interaction was less, although the girls were still going in with the wire clip. I mean, I was looking after the fire. Dawn, look after the camp, keep the fire going. We're going to go in and we'll be back shortly. If we don't come, go and get help, this kind of thing. But I mean, what you're supposed to do, I don't know. But, you know, they were still active in a sense, but obviously pretty low key. There was only small numbers of women. Really, for me, most of the unpleasantness and the things that had happened had occurred, they shared with me around the fire of an evening. But I already knew a lot from my other friends who had spent time at Greenham and were very much more, you know, so I was very aware when I went there. But it was good to have the interaction with the women as well, and be part of it for the little bit I did. And a short time.
Yes.
So it was less than a year, really, that I was going there.
Yes. Thank you. And I understand there were some ladies from Japan that you became.
Yeah, hence the other photograph. This was quite amusing because we were all sitting round the fire. We'd had a bit of breakfast one morning, just sitting round chatting, having a cup of tea. And suddenly these women, and I, tiny women, they were really much shorter than us, turned up. And we soon realised, of course, these women were actually Japanese. And we all kind of looked at each other, and then one of the women said, oh, my goodness. And they had a letter from some women in Japan who had a peace camp there. And they'd heard about Greenham, bearing in mind there's no social, you know what I mean? You had letters, you had newspapers, you had television, which we didn't have. There was no electricity, obviously. So, but somehow they had heard about Greenham and had said, we would like to come over. And so, of course, the girls just wrote back and said, yeah, anytime, come and join us. And they just turned up this particular day, unexpectedly. And they said, what can we? And they gave me their tents and all their gear, and they just set up as a group. I'm going to say that it was obviously they had lived through the experience of nuclear, of a nuclear bomb. And you know, it's very real for them what we were doing here in England, even though we hadn't been affected. And but the problem was they had literally no English. So unfortunately, there wasn't a great deal of conversation, but the common purpose was there, and they just wanted to come and see what Yellow Gay were doing and to be there and part of it and experience it. And as I say, they were from a peace camp. I mean, I'm going to say Hiroshima, but I'm sure they were near there, if not there itself, yes. And had been for many years as well. So they just said, what can we do? And so we said, well, you know, just muck in. Do, you know, nobody has any set jobs. Everybody just does. The dung is there, you know, if you need to go to the loo, this is that and that's it sort of thing. And then we got what you see them pushing is actually was a some sort of contraption that they built to go to the standpipe and get fresh water. So what they were doing, they said, oh, we'll go get some water. And they said, well, it's up there and da, da, da. And off they went and they came back, Julie, with these plastic containers with fresh water in. And that's that photo. Mm.
And so do you know how long they stayed at the camp?
No, I don't. They were still there when I left and they'd gone when I went back. So, it was only a matter of a week or two. They weren't there a great length of time. But, yeah, it's quite interesting just experiencing them turning up, coming all that way just to experience Greenland. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, I know women did, and the highest of Greenland come from all over the world. I'm aware of that. But to see them turn up when there was just Yellowgate right at the end of it, making this last stand, as it were, and refusing to go until the weapons had gone. And that's what they did do. But then when I said to the... I then had to leave because I had a plan to do this trip, this travelling. And so I had to stop going. But we knew that they had a withdrawal date at that time, that they were actually, the weapons were going and it was closing. And there was one heck of a celebration. But I then said to these women, what's next? And they just said, Aldermost. So they weren't actually giving up even at that. They were going to then, so I said, I hope the car and the caravan gets you there. You know, it's quite a trip. But the plan was to go there. And at that point, I was away for over a year. I travelled for over a year. So I kind of lost touch, basically. So I don't know what happened after that.
And so I was interested when you said there was no organisation of jobs and people just did. Tell me how that worked.
I think the thing is because there were small numbers, they'd been there that long, these women, they were all either permanent, virtually or semi-permanently there or whatever. Everything just fell into place. They didn't need to delegate. I'm sure if there's large numbers, you would have to, but under the circumstances with smaller numbers, it wasn't really necessary. Everybody knew what needed doing first up with the fire and so on. So they just went along. I think the other thing which is interesting for me is because there was a small number in particular, that their menstrual cycle fitted in completely with the phase of the moon.
Right, how interesting.
And they all, their menstrual cycle all went with the phase of the moon, and they all had their periods at the same time, and literally within that same period. And I think that, you know, things like that, just living outside, living under the moon, how nature came back, not really anything necessary to do with Greenham, but fascinating all the same, yeah.
Interesting. And so could you paint a picture for me about sitting round the fire in an evening? And were you telling stories? Were you...
Yeah, I mean, it is about sharing. I mean, depending on the time of the year, obviously. I mean, I was there till at the end of the summer. So, you know, the evenings kind of got pretty cold. So the fire was essential and you were very much, you know, it was blankets, big coats, because it really did get cold. So it wasn't a late night that you were out, really, because there was no light, obviously. The summer evenings obviously would have been totally different in that sense. But, yeah, it's just sharing things. But I think once we'd sort of made some food and eaten and a cup of tea or whatever, or if somebody was fortunate enough to have a beer, they might have had a beer or something. But that's about it, really. I think it was just sharing things, and especially for me, because I'm a bit of a curious person anyway, in as much as I want to know. So I was kind of picking their brains a lot of the time I was there. And so, well, what was the Janet Taverner? How did you see that when that happened, this woman that was killed there? And they were just so angry about that whole thing. And it was interesting to see their perspective on that and various things that had happened that I was aware of and that I'd either read or heard from friends about. So, there was lots of sharing of stuff. And they were interested in where I was going, because I was going walkabout with my backpack and going off. And a woman of 40-odd doing that, they said, that's pretty unusual, Dawn. And I said, yeah. There's not a lot normal about me in that sense. You know, I kind of, it's the first time in my life I've had the opportunity to do it. And I thought, right, do it before you're too old and you can't do it. So that's what I did. And so, yeah, you're just sharing, talking, yes, chatting. It's just lovely. Yeah.
And where were you off to? Where were you backpacking to?
Well, I'm starting in Canada. I had a cousin in Canada and I had a couple of friends in Canada. So I started in Canada. I then had friends and my last stop and headed due south, basically. And I went down into the States, into America. And I had a cousin in Oklahoma where I got jabbed up because I was heading south. But the main part of it for me, in the kind of backpacking bit, started when I hit Central America, and that's where I spent most of my time. It was, yeah, all the seven countries in all I did, and just sort of wandered with a one-way ticket, no plans, which was wonderful, because I think it's all very nice. We all look forward to a holiday, but you've kind of got like this week slot or this 2 week slot, and I hate that. And it was the first opportunity, because I'd been a single parent for most of my son's life. You know, you don't have these choices. We didn't have the money. We didn't have the choices. I didn't have the choice to do these things. So it wasn't until he was sort of like, okay, he's doing his thing. He's left home and he's settled and blah, blah, blah. And all he said when I said I wanted to do it, I wanted to go walk about, he said, I said, how do you feel about it if I say I'm going to go walk about and I'm going to go blah, blah. I said, go for it, Mum, not a problem. But can you get in touch just every week, let me know where you are and that you're okay? Because he didn't know where I was going to be any more than I did from week to week. So, it was a year. So, but it was wonderful. I had a great time. But, yes, it was good, because I think from the women at Greenham, you know, it was kind of interesting for them to hear, have an output of, or rather an input from somebody else that wasn't there all the time, and get something interesting from them as well if they turned up. So likewise, if other women turned up, it we were asking them about their life or what they were doing, you know, and had they been to Greenham in its height and things like that. Just general chat, really.
Yes. Oh, very courageous.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
A lone journey. What did your son think about you going to Greenham, I wonder?
Oh, he'd grown up with me working. I worked for over 11 years with Oxfam. So he grew up very much aware of my politics and my thoughts around the injustices and all the various stuff. I also dragged him along to the odd amnesty thing and things. So it was just part of who I was. Mm. So he was not at all surprised. But, I mean, he was an adult at that time. No, he wasn't surprised at all.
And I think, do you have some pictures of the murals done by Katerina?
I think you have received one of them, haven't you?
Yes.
I gave one to Emma. Yeah, what that was, Katrina really was, I would say, I don't know if she saw herself as that, but I'm sure the others did, very much the kingpin of Yellow Gate. She's the one that had been there the longest, had been there 9 years. And she used to get sheeting or sailcloth or whatever whenever she could afford, and she had like a washing line in between the trees, and she would paint these wonderful big murals. They were stunning, and I was really impressed with them when I got there, and I thought, these are amazing. And at that time I was anticipating buying a little place that needed total refurbishment in Devon, and it had a big arch and two sort of, and I said, if I gave you specific sort of sizes and things, could you do me two banners, anything you want? They were all women-centred, obviously, but these two. And she said, oh, I'd love to. And I said, obviously, I will pay you and blah, blah. And so she made these two banners for me. Well, I never did buy the place, but I've always had them. And when I was talking to Emma and I said about the photographs, she said, had I got anything else? And I said, well, I've got these banners. I said, I've been looking after them all these years, but I haven't actually got them up. This place I'm living in now is so tiny. So I said, I have these two banners. Well, I explained one to a friend of mine who totally fell in love with them, who came to see me. And I have a photograph of her. She's put it as she walks up her stairs to go to bed every night. There's this massive banner hanging down on the landing. So, you know, you can see the thing in full. So she has that one. The other one I gave, which I'm happy to donate to Emma to give to you. So hopefully you've got that. But her work was amazing. I just loved it. I mean, it made a little bit of money for her as well. So rather than just sort of needing money, she could earn, you know, a bit of money to help. I mean, you don't really get an income if you don't have an address, do you?
It's difficult. So
hard, very hard. The financial side was always a struggle.
And so why do you think the reason is that the suffrage movement seems to have been celebrated and the Green movement hasn't received the same kind of celebration?
I think there's a mixed belief within people. I've had many conversations with various people over the years. I mean, when I was a member of CND, and I can remember being on the marches and things, you would get a lot of support, but you'd also get a lot of negative stuff from the public and things like that, what you were doing was wrong and we need to defend our country. And so depending on the political, I think it's about politics, basically, because I think the propaganda that was put out, especially at that time by governments, was, you know, well, we've got to defend ourselves and that's why they're here and all this business. So, yeah, I think the public were divided, as I'm sure there was division in the suffragettes. I mean, not all. There was an anti-women's suffragette movement as well, wasn't there? It was quite rife down here, actually. I work at my local museum and they've got quite a lot of information about that here. And it's quite interesting. So, gosh, half of America voted Trump in, didn't they? I mean, come on, you know, you're always going to have some, you know, a section of society which will conflict with what to me seems right, but for them isn't. And I think it's fear. A lot of it's fear based, probably. I think a suffragette, I mean, it was purely a male male situation that the control was so dominantly governed women in that respect that it was just a different movement. I mean, having said that, the press, the media really went to town on Greenham, didn't they? They really covered it big time. I can remember seeing it on the news and in the press, some of it good, some not. So there's always going to be that split.
Do you think gave fair coverage?
Do you know, I don't know that I can even remember it all. It was that long ago. I would have been biased anyway. And I'm a bit of a Guardian. If I'm going to buy a newspaper, it would be The Guardian. So I'm a bit sort of, I'm always going to be toward the left. So it was really from a political angle. And I think really when it comes to press and media, the politics play a big part in that. Mm-hmm. And when I think of what the governments were like in that, you know, the government was like in that at that point, at that time, they wouldn't have been at all supportive, obviously. So they would have cast a shadow as much as they can, as they always have with women's issues, I think. It's always been a struggle, and it always will be, I think. So as I said with a friend, we were on a march in Exeter not that long ago, before COVID has stopped us. But the Reclaim the Night march, you've probably heard of, about keeping women safe at night. And we had a gathering, we did a lovely march in Exeter, the nearest city to where I live here in Devon. And we were doing the march, and everybody had the opportunity to go in and make their own banner if they wanted in the hall where we started. And people were writing their banners about keeping women safe at night and the freedom for women. And my old friend came on, and you'll have to excuse my language here because I need to swear because that's what she said. And she just put on her banner. But she's my age, well, a bit younger than me, but she's kind of approaching 70. And she's got this banner, and on it, it said, "I can't believe I'm still doing this fucking stuff." Because in many respects, although we've had a lot of changes, there hasn't been enough, you know. And I mean, the nuclear weapons, poor old Scotland's got them, haven't they? So the nuclear stuff. So, you know, crazy. But there you go.
So you're
getting better, but very slowly.
Campaigning still goes on. I wonder if you think that the kind of the tactics for the Greenham campaign of non-violence, is there any learning to be taken from then to now in terms of the way protests are made, do you think?
Well, of course, there was violence. The bit that some women might have gone a bit over the top at times. I mean, it basically was non-violent, but there were some women who didn't behave that well. Yellowgate were great sticklers to non-violence, totally across the board. They just wouldn't tolerate it. But I think in the heyday, there was a bit of naughty going on. From what I hear, I wasn't there. But the violence was, if there was violence, was, you know, perpetrated by the other side. Well, of course, if the police are trying to, you know, if you're being manhandled, you're going to perhaps fight back, that kind of thing. I mean, that went on when I was on marches with CND and all sorts of other places. It's no different. The difference is the police on the whole, it didn't matter whether they were women, they still were quite brutal at times. They were handled very badly, some of these women. They wouldn't just put them into the back of a van, they would literally physically throw them and things like that. So the police behaviour was pretty appalling from what I hear. I didn't experience it, I wasn't there. It's what I've been told from other women. Personally, I'm a peaceful demonstrator. I don't like violence. I abhor violence of any kind, any type. So even though it's something I'm extremely passionate about, I might swear and shout at them, but I'm not going to be physically or destructive in any way other than that. Yeah, I am responsible for sometimes swearing and being rather abusive, but that's about as far as my violence goes. Personally, that's my view. But and do I take a knee for Black Lives Matter? Yes, I do. But it's peaceful demonstration. I don't like violence of any sort.
Yes.
Although I do understand why some people resort to it.
So how would you like Greenham to be celebrated?
I think the word resilience comes in for me because I was there toward the end with only a small number of women still defiantly being there all that time, with no intentions at all of giving up. It's that resilience, I think, for me. And the when you get like-minded women together, my goodness, they're powerful and they're strong and they're determined, and it's amazingly empowering. It's interesting because for me at that time, going traveling, the one thing that people keep saying, I remember being with some friends in the pub, and you know, my friends saying, you know, why are you doing this? Why now? What are you doing going off traveling on your own down into Central America? I mean, El Salvador, Nicaragua, all these countries that were so all dreadful. Least of all Mexico. So they said, oh no, you're dumb, you know. And I said, no, I'm going. I want to do it. I want to do it. I've been putting it on. And the guys were the funny thing, because they were going to say, that's really dangerous. Are you going on your own? So I said, yes, I'm going on my own. And they said, well, that's a bit dangerous, isn't it? And I said, what's my biggest fear? And they didn't want to say. I had to tell them. I said, it's you guys. It's men on the whole. Whether it's a soldier or a guy out or somebody that's just short of money or whatever, as a backpacking woman on her own, the fear is fundamentally men. If I get sick, I've got insurance, you know, it's going to be men on the whole. And I said, you just don't want to say it. And I said, if there's going, you think for one moment that a man's going to stop me doing what I want to do, no, you know, that is not going to stop me. And I think these women at Greenham, they took a lot of abuse from the police. They took a lot of, you know, okay, the police had a job to do, I appreciate, you know, it's difficult, but the kind of manhandling, the kind of behaviour that went on, and the behaviour and the treatment they got if they got taken to Holloway as well, wasn't much better. And you know, there are ways and ways of controlling people. They had a job to do, but I think, you know, that kind of abusive behaviour is not on. The suffragettes had it, and Greenham women had it and experienced it. But yeah, it's just the resilience. You know, if you're determined, you've just got to do it, haven't you? Yeah. Don't let anything stop you.
Wonderful message. And kind of looking forwards now, why do you think it is important that Greenham is remembered by future generations?
Yeah, it's more relevant, I think, as if not more relevant today, the real threats. But it's all to do with the whole nuclear thing. It's not just Greenham. Greenham is part of that group of determined people who were trying desperately. I mean, once upon a time, CND was quite powerful in this country. Nobody, young people don't hear about it today. They just don't hear about it. It's not something that's spoken about. Whereas, you know, in as we know, 60s, 70s, that era, you know, CND, all right, it was fashionable. But it was also very active. And unfortunately, these things have just really, unless you get a body of people and you get enough people to have enough power to bring it to the attention of the media and things like that, that's what brings the numbers in. But today, with social media, which we didn't have in those days, it was just the press and TV or radio. Today, I mean, I say this lightly, it's very easy to activate, you know, to get people active. But you've got to be so careful with that, because obviously it can also be a very damaging thing if you're attracting not necessarily like-minded people, you're getting people for the wrong reasons. So, I think nuclear power sadly is here. The resistance isn't there from the public for whatever reason. Younger people, I don't know, they just seem to accept it. The fact that it's part of life. And they're more, I don't know, really. I don't mix with enough young people, to be perfectly honest. I should. But I don't. So I haven't really discussed it with many young people and their attitude toward nuclear power and the whole thing. I mean, we're supposed to be building this new station, aren't we, for nuclear. You know, it's still very much ongoing. I honestly don't know, because I don't think I'm as in touch with what's going on out there as I used to. I live in Sidmouth. There's so many elderly people here. So I you know, there's a lovely Amnesty group and you know, we're still around, but my banner waving days are sort of coming toward an end now. I haven't got the energy to hold the thing up, least of all anything else. So I think it's down to young people, but there seems to be a bit of apathy out there. You just don't hear about any, you know, many people. I mean, I may be underplaying this. I don't know, tens of hundreds, thousands of young people out there who are very supportive. I don't know, is really what I'm saying, because I'm really not that in touch with young people. But I should be, but I'm not.
Maybe in your museum there'll be a little Greenham corner.
Oh, well, there is. No, there's not a Greenham, because we're local, of course. But yeah, as I say, the suffragette, we celebrated in the museum the suffragette movement and their centenary, as did in a couple of lovely home houses and places with the National Trust. Did a grand job, I think, on the suffragette movement, their centenary. I thought it was really good. Yeah, it's, but I think that the Greenham, it's interesting that it took women, and I think history has always, I think, supported the fact that if you want wars, it's men, and if you want peace, it's women, and it just seems that this is women's role. We're we try to make peace, don't we, on the whole. I won't say everybody, but on the whole, we try to make the peace, and we want things nice, don't we? We don't want power in the same way on the whole, and you know, we're just seen as different beings, I think. For that reason, I think the fact that there were very few men there set it all, really. I mean, there were some men, obviously there were lots of men who supported the suffragette movement, but you know, it was very much a women-centred thing. Even though the men benefited from it,
yes,
as we know.
And there were many husbands who supported their wives, many husbands and partners who supported their wives at the camp.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet any of them?
Yeah, well, yeah. I met over the years. I met loads of women. I mean, there were, you know, I through my connections with Oxfam, of course, who, you know, we hated anything to do. Most, you know, colleagues and things like that hated. It's just I wasn't allowed to get involved in that sense, but and be actively involved. I think they were worried I was going to get arrested, and then it'd be, oh gosh, you know, bring Oxfam into it or something. They probably didn't trust me.
Yes.
So they. and the thing was, I was the area manager for Central London. So I think because it was everything was London centred, as it still is, tends to be. And so consequently, I think I was a little bit more volatile to anything in the press. It's difficult. It's difficult. But yes, loads of men were incredibly supportive. My son just sort of, you wouldn't you, Mum, kind of thing, because that's what I did, you know. Because I could equally have been on a CND thing or something else.
Yes.
Greenpeace. All those things are trying to make it a better world for people, but yeah.
And so do you have any question that you wish I might have asked that you would like to answer?
The only thing that was incredibly futile that went on, I think, was the behaviour of the local council and the bailiffs, really. But again, it was probably a legal thing. They were going through this process of turning up every week, you know, uninvited, and just turfing the women off the land. You had to physically remove everything, otherwise they would take it. And they used to come with this open back truck, wire cage truck, which, you know, they use for clearing rubbish, I suppose, around the borough. And they turn up uninvited, toot their horn to let, you know, sometimes early in the morning, women weren't even up and they'd have to scramble, and they'd only give them so much time to clear everything off the land and drive the vehicles off and everything. You know, they weren't about to leave them in peace at all. And I think that was even right up the end, even right up to when I was there. You know, it just seemed rather futile and petty. They weren't doing anything wrong by being there. But that could have been, and I think we did discuss this, because I said, this is ridiculous, why are they doing this? And they all said, oh, they come, you know, when I first started going there, oh, they come every week, and they just turn up and toot their horn early in the morning and make us take down the tents. And then they would just kick out the fire and put the fire out. And petty, really, you know. But I do remember discussing it. And I was like, well, it's probably a bylaw, which, you know, laws do, because, you know, as much as they were sort of, if you like, tolerating them, still being there, technically they could come, and they legally were allowed to come and do this thing every now and again, which was also very unpleasant. But yeah, the women were used to it. They've been doing it for years. It's just something they accepted that it had to be done.
And presumably they then had to relight the fire and set up the camp again.
Yeah, and these guys, I mean, you know, they knew that's exactly what would happen, but still they come and do this thing every, as I say, about every week, whenever, you know. It was usually, as I say, early in the morning, which is almost like they did it on purpose, you know, oh, we'll come and get them out, you know. Half the time the women were still asleep. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, but as you know, they had a job to do. I mean, it wasn't their fault. Somebody made the decision, not them, I suppose.
Yeah. And so finally then, how would you sum up your Greenham experience, reflecting on it now?
I think for women, and I think for a lot of women, I don't know, I can't speak for the other women, but I know I have heard it said, and I've said it myself in the past, I think it's quite whenever you get a solid, a kind of solidarity in a group of women together, it's an empowering thing. That's why I think it's important not to have violence and to be, you know, very much a non-black, because, you know, you put a gang of human beings together and they're angry. You know, sometimes they don't behave how personally I feel they should. And so I think passive, non-violent, aggressive demonstrations and such are great. I've done it all my life, one way or another, for various things. And I think, I don't like anger, but you do find people being very angry. But for me personally, I just found it very empowering and wonderful to see how strong women can be. And how, as I say, that word resilience for me is something, and determined women can be when they're together. We've always, as people were saying to me when I went backpacking, you're very vulnerable on your own, but, you know, how can you do that? But it's very obvious when there's a group of women, they are extremely powerful. And those women were powerful, resilient, determined, all those things. And it's a wonderful energy. I felt very privileged to be, as much as it was only a small part of it. Never forget it. It was great. I do wonder where those women are now, what they're doing and how they are. Were they a little bit younger than me? I was 40. What would I have been? 41, I suppose, something like that. So some of them were quite a bit, you know, a little bit younger than me, although they weren't youngsters. They weren't young. They weren't teenagers. But, it'd be interesting to know if they did get to Aldermaston and carry on their determined fight there. Very privileged to be there.
Right. That's a wonderful note to end on, if you have nothing else that you wish to add. And so I'd like to say thank you very much for taking this time and sharing your story.